The difference is in terms of technological development, in terms of social protection, in terms of the capacity of people to pay for the goods they need. And the fact is that the current system does allow very limited differentiation. And therefore, I think we need to continuously work in order to increase the flexibility and the room for introduce differentiation into the intellectual property system. As the World Bank itself has said, in the area of intellectual property, one size does not fit all. That means that we cannot expect the same institution to work in the same way in such different contexts. A third conclusion I would draw is that quite clearly in the case of developing countries, the granting of patents constitute a cost, generate a cost, which is not compensated by the benefits that patents may bring about, as I mentioned before. And finally, it is clear that government could take measures in order to mitigate the impact of the situation I have just described, to mitigate the impact of the monopolistic exercise of rights. The fact is, however, that the room of maneuver that governments have been left in order to do this, in order to mitigate the monopolistic power, has been drastically reduced by international agreements. It is clearly unethical, in my view, the situation that we live in today, in which products, medicines are available in order to treat people, but these medicines cannot be provided to the people in need. I think that we need to work very very hard in order to scrutinize what the governments do in this area. Governments are in most cases pushed by business interest. Intellectual property law and patent laws are not designed on the basis of public interest. They are designed on the basis of what the business, the powerful business interest are able to convey, and this is currently the situation in the design of intellectual property law. So I think, just to conclude, that the issue we are addressing in this conference, the issue of access to drugs, the issue of right to health, is too important for everybody, is too important for developed and developing countries, is too important for humanity as a whole, just to leave it to bureaucrats in governments and to the business interests to decide what people can get and what people cannot get in this area. Thank you very much.
And we invite Thomas to give the last word.
Okay, I want to conclude with a clear and hopefully straightforward line of argument that draws on the two preceding speakers and ties it together in a way that highlights also your responsibilities as individual Canadian citizens or citizens of the wealthier countries in regard to the problems that we have discussed. The argument begins with the causal efficacy and causal role of social institutions. By social institutions, I mean, in the first instance, the rules of the game, the way in which social systems, such as societies, but also humankind at large, are structured and organized. Now, it's very clear that the social rules that structure a social system have a causal effect, in particular, on the distribution of quality of life. You can see that, for example, in minor ways, when you compare reforms in the tax system, you look at different tax systems in different countries or changes in the tax code in one country, and you can see that if taxes become more progressive, then inequalities go down. If taxes become less progressive, inequalities go up, and so on. But there are, of course, much deeper structural features of institutional schemes, such as, for example, whether you have a feudalist society or a capitalist society or whether you live in China before Deng Xiaoping's reforms or afterwards, whether you have a Latin American country with land reform or without land reform, and so on. So all you need to remember for now is that the way in which a social system is structured has a causal impact on quality of life, hardly a contentious point. Second, the way an institutional scheme is shaped and designed is something for which human agents bear responsibility. So you, as Canadian citizens, insofar as you are, bear responsibility shared with other Canadian citizens for the structure of the institutional order of your society. Third, you might then conclude that it's wrong for you collectively to impose an institutional order that is unjust. For example, if Canadian, a majority of Canadians were tomorrow to institute feudalism with the foreseeable result that lots of people would be very poor, that would be a wrong that you would be committing against these people by imposing on them an unjust institutional order. Now, there are obviously zillions of different theories about what justice is exactly. And in order to bypass that difficulty, let's just agree on some very minimal constraints. So instead of saying what is justice, let's ask what is certainly unjust. And it seems to me that here a kind of common denominator, an overlapping consensus, revolves around the notion of human rights. It's a very minimal notion. An institutional order is certainly unjust if it satisfies these four conditions. That is to say, a particular social system is so structured that it produces massive human rights deficits. These massive deficits are foreseeable. It's foreseeable that it is producing them. These massive human rights deficits are reasonably avoidable through an alternative institutional design. And the fact that they are so avoidable is also reasonably foreseeable. We can know that this alternative design would, in fact, do much better. And so if you take this very minimal conception of what is certainly unjust, then you can use that, for example, to disqualify a system that licenses slavery, feudalism, and also violence against women, a society that does not have any laws, legal protections for women against domestic violence, would be a system that avoidably produces violations of human rights in a way that is foreseeably avoidable through incorporating these protections. Okay, so once we have a very rudimentary notion of injustice, we can then go on and say, what sort of a moral claim do individuals on whom a particular institutional scheme is imposed, what sort of moral claims do they have? And here's once more what James already cited, number 28 of the Universal Declaration, where human rights are explicitly presented as these minimal constraints. Everyone is entitled to have institutions imposed upon them, be they national institutions or international institutions, be so shaped that they do not give rise to avoidable massive human rights violations. Particularly relevant for our topic is one of the human rights. You see, 28 is referring to the other rights and freedoms mentioned in the Declaration, and one of those other rights and freedoms is particularly important, namely the right to a standard of living adequate for the health and well-being of oneself and one's family, including food, clothing, housing, and medical care. So my paraphrase would then be that a human right to X, whatever else it does, also gives you a moral claim against all others that they should not harm you by cooperating without compensating reform and protection efforts in imposing upon you an institutional order under which you lack secure access to X as part of a foreseeable and avoidable human rights deficit. So that is on the side of the person who is suffering deprivations. That's the claim such a person has, and the claim that would be violated by an unjust order being imposed upon him or her. At the other end, there is the individual responsibility of anyone participating in designing or imposing an institutional scheme on others. Such a person must not cooperate in designing and imposing such an unjust institutional order, and when they do so without making compensating reform efforts or compensating protection efforts to the victims of this institutional order, they are involved collectively in violating the human rights of those on whom an institutional order is imposed. Now, if we look at the global system in particular as one institutional order, a worldwide institutional order that has formed already for several centuries but is becoming increasingly important in terms of its causal effects, then we get something like this diagram here, where the two poles are connected. On the right-hand side at the bottom, you have millions of people who suffer severe deprivations, 18 million people dying each year. That can be traced back to unjust institutions, both at the national and the global level, and unjust global institutions, an unjust global institutional order, can in turn be traced back to the governments that are negotiating and upholding that order, and then finally indirectly traced back to the citizens of the countries whose governments are playing the major role in designing and imposing this order. So that's the basic picture. Now, let me say two things to meet objections. One thing that's often said in response to this sort of simple picture is that membership in the global order, participation in the WTO, for example, is certainly voluntary. So countries can sign up or not sign up as they see fit. And to that, I want to make four responses very quickly. One is that human rights are generally conceived as inalienable, so consent is not viewed as capable of waiving a human right. You cannot consent to slavery, for example. Secondly, children certainly cannot possibly have consented to the deprivations they suffer, and we saw already that the vast majority of people dying prematurely are children. There's also the problem of the lack of democratic legitimacy of those who sign up to international arrangements. Among those signing up to the WTO, for example, were Sani Abacha, Mobutu Sese Seko, Suharto, the SLORC, State Law and Order Restoration Council of Myanmar, and so on. And finally, there's of course the matter of duress, that there were enormous discrepancies in bargaining power and expertise that resulted in the present WTO treaty, including the TRIPS agreement. Ditto for bilateral agreements. Another objection that can be made, and I don't have time to discuss it fully, is that you say, well, yes, there's a causal influence from the global institutional order to these deprivations that we have observed, but there are other agents who also, if they change their conduct, could get rid of the vast majority of these deprivations. So people say, if only the institutional structures of many of the poorer countries were better organized, if only they were better governed, then many of these problems would not occur. And that is right insofar as it puts blame on those institutional structures and on the governments and ruling elites of those countries. But it does not, I think, have the effect to get us off the hook in terms of our responsibility for the design of global institutional rules. If it did, then it would seem that both sides can get off the hook simply by pointing at the other. So one side can say, look, you know, if you acted differently, then we wouldn't have that mess. And the other side says, so I'm innocent. And then the other side says, well, if you acted differently, we wouldn't have the mess, and so therefore I'm innocent. So think of two factories both polluting a river with different chemicals. Each of the chemicals is harmless by itself, but the mixture of the two is very deadly, killing thousands of people downstream who depend on that river for food and drink. In that case, if each of the two factory owners could say, look, my chemicals are harmless, and therefore I am certainly not responsible for the resulting deaths, then they could continue their activities, and people would be dying downstream forever, with neither of the two factory owners doing anything wrong. That's obviously absurd. So we have to say that responsibility attaches to both of these factory owners. But people defending the existing global order might say there's an important asymmetry, namely the ruling elites of the developing countries are downstream from us in a causal sense. So they are behind us in the causal chain, and that makes the difference. Our conduct isn't really harmful. We just have a certain global order designed in a certain way, and if they acted well further down the line, the great health problems that we find would not occur. And again, I find that an implausible argument. And again, I would illustrate that with two factory owners and the river. If you just think of the second factory owner being somewhat downstream, that would not get the first owner off the hook if the first owner knows that, as a matter of fact, the second factory will pollute with the other chemical. There's also the matter that our global institutional order has a significant impact on the quality of government in many of the developing countries, and in that way also contributes to this other factor, which supposedly is meant to relieve us of responsibility. Anyway, the main conclusion then is that we as individual citizens of the affluent countries bear a responsibility for the great deprivations suffered in the developing countries on account of us and our governments cooperating in designing and upholding a global institutional order that foreseeably and avoidably causes massive human rights deficits. And we can then solve that problem and our moral involvement, our moral responsibility for these deprivations in basically three ways. We can stop cooperating as individuals or as countries. We can also compensate for our continued contribution, our continued cooperation, either by working for institutional reforms or by working to protect the victims of the existing institutions. These options are illustrated by different NGOs, for example, and also illustrated by our participants here at the meeting. For the most part, I think we will focus this meeting on political and institutional reforms. We'll think about institutional reforms. Last slide. I mean, one thing that is, I think, in need of reform and that we can think about reforming is the present way of incentivizing pharmaceutical innovations. And here I'm just restating the points that Carlos already made, namely that the existing system of incentivizing pharmaceutical innovation has two important pathological effects, very bad effects. One is that life-saving medicines are priced because of the monopoly pricing power given to inventor firms, are priced out of the reach of many poor patients, even though their cost of production is actually vastly lower, as Carlos has already said. And secondly, and even more importantly, there is no sufficient incentive for inventor firms to attend to many of the health problems that are concentrated among the very poor, simply because there you cannot make a lot of money by inventing new medicines because poor people couldn't afford them at the high monopoly prices anyway. And you see here, if you look at the last sentence of that slide, you see here that of the 1,393 new drugs approved between 1975 and 1999, only 13 were for tropical diseases, and of those 13, five were byproducts of veterinary research and two were developed for the military. So there's a very lopsided attention on the health problems of the rich, very little attention to the health problems of the poor. Now, people in response to that sometimes come with a dichotomy, which I think is a false dichotomy. They say either we have pharmaceutical innovation, and then unfortunately we'll just have to bite the bullet and exclude many poor people from the benefits, or we have no pharmaceutical innovation at all, and we just go back to the Middle Ages or a system where essentially no medical treatments come online. That is quite obviously a false dichotomy, because there are other ways of incentivizing pharmaceutical research. There are ways of incentivizing it that do not exclude the very poor. Now, what these are, we have perhaps different views about, but much of what we will discuss will center around the question of how we can have both pharmaceutical innovation and access to essential drugs by the poor. If such a system can be devised, and I'm sure that there is more than one that can be devised, then relative to it, the existing design of the global distribution of the global institutional order constitutes a very massive human rights violation in virtue of the fact that it foreseeably and avoidably leads to these enormous deprivations that we've outlined. Thank you.
Thank you very much, and we're now into the second part of the roundtable. I'd like to invite Alexander Capron, Director of Ethics, Trade, Human Rights, and Health Law at the World Health Organization, to respond to what he's heard from our panelists.
Good evening. This morning at about 6 o'clock Geneva time, which is more or less the time when many of you were probably getting ready to go to bed here, I was at my office getting ready for the day and getting ready to go to the airport. And little did I know when I arrived here that I would not find my dear colleague Jim Kim, who is the person of whom James was speaking when he talked about the person who came from Partners for Health and brought to WHO the determination to act on the pledge that had already existed, that by the end of 2005, 3 million patients would be on antiretroviral medications for HIV. I don't know whether we are going to make that number. It looks as though we may not. But in the meantime, the G8 nations have been energized to pledge that by 2010, the upward curve should have taken us to universal access. Now, I think the theory of this conference is that that development as just one emblem, and James gave you other ones, of the confrontation with the kinds of problems that Thomas described, the problems brought on by the massive poverty that affects the better part of the world, that is best understood in human rights terms. That is to say that human rights violations can pose a threat to health, slavery, the brutalization of women. These human rights violations challenge health. That the enforcement of human rights, the right to participation, the right to information, the right to education can advance health, and that the right to health itself can be a means of focusing the attention of those who have the power to act on the necessity of acting to create a world in which the kinds of daily human toll that we saw on those slides no longer occurs, that the avoidable harms of which Thomas just spoke no longer occur. Now, several of the questions that were posed, the five questions that were posed, I think have had some good and interesting answers. Why do so many people still lack access to essential medicines? Because they can't afford the ones that exist, and that the ones that they need are not being developed because of the incentive system that Carlos described. What can and should be done to improve the situation? Well, James described several things that are being done to improve the situation. The final question on the list says, what, if anything, do national and international public institutions have to do with the responsibilities to enforce human rights? And I have to say that that is a challenge for the World Health Organization. Because we are an intergovernmental organization, we do not have the freedom that an NGO has in terms of activism and advocacy. But we do have the advantage that all 192 of our member states are in fact signatories to at least one of the human rights instruments. And so one of the things that we can do is to remind them of the obligations that those instruments create, which are obligations not of individuals, but of the government as a whole. And this leads to a couple of the questions that I'd like to pose to the panelists. What are the things about the right to health, or as we're reminded by some of our member states, not to use quite that phrase, the right to health, but rather the right to the highest attainable standard of health without discrimination? That right appears in the WHO Constitution, right at the beginning of the preamble of the Constitution. And that right is very broadly conceived. I wonder how many of you know the definition of health in the WHO Constitution? Could I just see a show of hands? Many of you are in medicine and science, I guess, and so forth. Do you know that definition? It's an astonishing definition in some ways, because it says that health is not merely the absence of disease or disability, but rather physical, psychological, and social well-being. Now, some people think that precisely because the standard set by that language is so high, that the right really has no meaning. How many of us sitting here right now have full social and psychological and even physical well-being? We may, I hope most of us are, free of diseases, or at least highly contagious ones. But how many of us meet that standard? And yet, it seems to me that that language has a lot to say about the problems that we've heard here, because it is precisely the notion that the obligation involved is the obligation to seek a means not merely to protect people from the threats to their life, but to give them a basis to live a full life. But looked at in that fashion, it is not entirely clear to me that the language that exists in the Universal Declaration, which speaks of medical care, or our focus here at this symposium today, which focuses on medicines, has our attention focused on what is most important. And so I guess I would like to ask the panelists, I'll pose a couple of questions and then they can pick it if they want to answer any of them, or maybe they'd rather have your questions. But the question, if you had the opportunity to say to governments, not just to ministries of health, but to governments, that something should be done, would your first focus be on breaking through the patent system? Would your first focus be on getting medicines? Or are there many other determinants of that life, of life as a life worth living, that you would address first? Now, to the extent, a second question, to the extent that we have heard that most of the problems in the present system seem to be that the pharmaceutical companies that develop drugs develop a lot of me-too drugs for those of us in the rich part of the world. They do it in such a way, and they use the patent system in such a way as to keep the prices as high as possible so that we spend an ever-increasing amount of our personal incomes and of the gross domestic products of the developed world on healthcare, and the greatest driver of that increasing healthcare is not payments to doctors or even the charges of ever more technological hospitals, but is the increasing costs of medications. And if the problems then lie with those private companies, do we now believe that they are bound by the human rights instruments which are signed by governments?